Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and welcome back to the Bunker Daily with me, Aisha Hazarika. The strangest and most surreal parliamentary sitting of our times has just staggered to its end. Hooray! But some people did manage to get a few things done. And one of them is Walthamstow MP Stella Creasy. With fellow MPs, she brought forward an amendment to the Domestic Abuse Bill to make misogyny a recordable motivator for crime, essentially identifying it as a hate crime. The bill is still in play, and since the debate, Stella has been running boot camps across the country. This has nothing to do with your muffin top. It's all about misogyny and how to get misogynistic crime classed as a hate crime. She's also been campaigning for childcare and early years support after the Chancellor inexplicably left it out of his measures to improve the jobs market and tackle youth unemployment. And all of this while changing nappies as a new mum. Famously, Stella is such an indie kid that last November, she gave birth to her daughter Hetty to the sound of There She Goes by The Lars. Hello, Stella.
Hey, Aisha.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. How are you? And how's Hetty?
She's cracking. Annoyingly, she's now at that age where you can't actually just leave her somewhere and come back 2 minutes later and she's in the same place because she started moving, which is absolutely terrifying and delightful at the same time.
And they can go at quite some pace, can't they? They can sort of really wriggle around quite fast.
I think she's going to dispense with the idea of crawling and go straight to walking because her trick at the moment is to pull herself upright. She's got kind of what's-her-face from The Terminator, Catherine O'Connor's shoulders. So she's pulling herself up on everything.
Has she got baby guns?
It's when I hear this kind of murmuring about I'll be back, I start being really frightened that I've got to sleep with one eye open.
Now, every single music fan can remember the last gig they went to before the lockdown and the one that got cancelled. Stella, what were yours? Or did pregnancy and childbirth stop you from going down the front for Porridge Radio at the Hackney Moth Club?
As if I'd ever go to Hackney. My last gig was obviously the wedding present. In fact, David Gedge came to Walthamstow. I was quite heavily pregnant, but I wanted to make sure that Hetty was getting good advanced tuition. So in fact, she started to move in my tummy when he started to, he was doing an acoustic set, which was absolutely brilliant. And my gig that got cancelled is Suede, which I'm absolutely gussed about for another reason. Suede Live are one of the best bands I've ever seen live. They're just brilliant. But the very first time I went to see them live, I went with a friend who has subsequently and sadly died. And so we were all going to go, a group of us, for a kind of memorial evening, and the gig has been put back a year, but we had been planning to go and see Suede at Ali Pali again.
Oh, that would have been amazing, and obviously in very moving circumstances. What I just loved, does the wedding present just revolve their gig schedule around you now?
Because you'd have to ask them that, but there might be a bit of a suspicion about it. The wedding present, absolutely, we have a fantastic venue in Walthamstow called the EMD that we've been spending 16 years now trying to get back into public use. There are some brilliant videos of a very young mayor who was me going, "We're going to fight to save the EMD." And I'm just getting older all the way through over the last 16 years. But I've always said the reason I want to get it back was to stage the indie gig of all indie gigs to end all time, because I believe that Walthamstow is the Sunnydale of all things good and proper, and so should be the place where this all starts. And David knows that he's on a promise to play that gig. So.
Okay, let's start with your campaign, a really important campaign to have misogyny classed as a hate crime in the Domestic Abuse Bill. Just explain to us a little bit about what you're trying to do and why it's important.
Yeah, so this is something we've been working with a number of organisations for a couple of years on now, ever since a number of police forces first started to do it. it's a very simple premise that if you are a woman right now, you're protected from discrimination and harassment and abuse in a workplace by legislation. But as soon as you step out onto the streets or you go home, you're not. What does that mean in practice? It means that 2/3 of young women report being sexually harassed on the streets, and 1/3 of them have changed their behaviour as a result, as in they haven't gone out, they've lived in a life of fear. We know that crimes like domestic abuse have high repeat rates. So there's patterns of behaviour that point to somebody being a victim of domestic violence. And we know in particular, it's women from minority communities who often experience abuse and harassment and have a really horrific experience trying to report it. Now, right now, if somebody harassed you because of the colour of your skin or your sexuality, the police would have a duty to record that and record that as a form of hate crime. And also that would be taken into account in the sentencing if the person who was caught doing it was put to trial. But if somebody harasses you for being a woman, that isn't taken into account. What does that mean in practice? It means that often it takes a long period of time before there's a recognition if, for example, there is somebody targeting women in a particular area. It means that for victims of domestic abuse, all too often those patterns, it takes a long time for people to recognise and act on. And it means that we can't recognise it in our legislative framework. And what the police tell you about hate crime is that actually, if you come forward and report it, you can help it stopping happening, not just to yourself, but to other people. Mm. What we're trying to do is make misogyny be classed as other forms of hatred, as a form of hate crime, so that the police would have to record where a crime is motivated by hate. And I want to be really clear, we're not talking about creating any new forms of crime. This is about existing crimes being categorised for what they are and what they're motivated by. And then courts could take it into account in the sentencing.
And so on a practical level, would that be, let's say, catcalling, or would it be if somebody was sort of harassed on public transport, or when it came to domestic violence, would it then change the categorization of the of let's say domestic violence?
Sure. So I mean, often it's interesting, in the time that we've been campaigning on this, absolutely people say, well, this is about criminalizing wolf whistling. Actually, wolf whistling, harassing somebody in the street, is already technically illegal. It's just that nobody ever does anything about it, essentially giving a green light to those people who think it's an acceptable thing to do, to harass women just going about their daily business, to carry on doing it. I mean, I've always said I'll stop this campaign when I go to the wedding where the bride gets up and says, well, I met him because he followed me down a dark street shouting, get in the back of the van, love, I'd like to feel your breasts. I haven't yet been to that wedding, so I'm pretty sure that street harassment is not something that people actually want to encourage, let alone say is somehow an acceptable part of modern day living. But actually, crucially, where this is already happening, so 5 police forces are already treating misogyny as a hate crime. What does that mean when a crime comes forward and the victim says, well, actually, I think this was about me being a woman? They record it as such. Nottinghamshire was the first police force to do this. It's not been wolf whistling that people are coming forward about. It's sexual assault, it's rape, it's kidnapping. Because what it does, as with other forms of hate crime, is it changes a culture in which this kind of behaviour is acceptable. You know, nobody thinks it is acceptable now to shout racial abuse at somebody in the street. Rightly, we ask for action to be taken. And what changing misogyny to a hate crime is, and recognising when it is involved in an illegal activity does, is it changes the tone and the expectation, not on the victim, but on the perpetrators. So what we've seen in areas where they've brought this policy in, say those 5 police forces, is that victims are much more likely to come forward because they're confident that the serious forms of sexual abuse and assault that they're facing, including things like domestic violence, will be taken seriously.
So they have trust, they have greater trust.
And that means there's been a higher level of reporting, and that helps you detect and prevent those crimes. Right now, if you're a woman from a minority community, or you're disabled, or you're gay, you have to choose which side of your identity has caused someone to be hostile to you. Recognising misogyny as a hate crime allows us to see the victim in her own right and to have a recognition that she is being targeted not because of one side of her personality, but because of who she is in her entirety.
So a woman of colour, for example, could have it, could have a crime what registered as misogyny and as a racially motivated attack.
Yeah. So it's not about saying, well, you have to have been wearing a hijab, for example, to be considered a hate crime. It's about recognising that people can be hostile to you for who you are, no matter what you've done, and that's not acceptable.
And just tell us, what's the state of play with that amendment? Have you got a lot of support for it, and what happens next?
Yeah, so what's been brilliant, and I must pay tribute to, there's over 20 organisations now, groups like Citizens, who've been doing fantastic work at a local level in communities across the country, making the case for this. The Joe Cox Foundation, the Fawcett Society, Hope Not Hate, Refuge, Women's Aid, Our Streets Now, who are these phenomenal, I mean, God, Aisha, they make me feel lazy, these phenomenal young women campaigners who've been leading action on this. And what we've got is a coalition of over 20 different organisations who all support the change, including several police representatives and people from those police forces. And we've been lobbying MPs and the Metro mayors, who obviously oversee the police, and the police and crime commissioners. And I'm really pleased to say that we've now got over 30 MPs who are committed to supporting the change. And we've got 5 Metro mayors who've committed to supporting the policy as well, including the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, and the Mayor of Manchester, Andy Burnham, and the Mayor of Liverpool, Steve Rotherham. And that's been down to local grassroots campaigners going and explaining that, you know, too often women in this country, when they get off the bus, have to put a set of keys in their hands to walk home. And that can't be the world we want to live in. You want everyone to be able to walk around free from fear. So you need to take away the fear.
And what are you confident that you will get enough support to get it passed, for it to become a clause in the domestic abuse bill?
Well, 2 years ago, we secured off the back of the upskirting bill, which is a classic example of a misogynistic crime. I mean, it doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens because there are certain people, mainly men, who think it's their right to take photos of women's upper woman's skirt and think that that's acceptable. But we managed to get the government to agree to review all hate crime in this country. So currently, right now, the Law Commission is reviewing all hate crime. This year, they came back and they told us, having looked at the review, they think there is the case for including misogyny in our hate crime framework. And so now they are going to consult on what that might look like. So we know the legislative change is coming. And once that comes, then the police will have to provide the evidence through recording it. What we were trying to do through the domestic abuse bill was to get that recording going, because they don't have to wait until the Law Commission reports to be able to do that. So the response we're getting from the government is, well, we need to see what happens with the Law Commission. And we're saying it's not an either or. We know that we've got the domestic abuse bill back into the House of Lords when Parliament returns in the autumn. There are other legislative opportunities. And one thing I've always believed is that you have to keep making your case. I always take a lesson from the great Caitlin Moran, who said, put the word yet at the end of any of your sentences. So if people don't support it, you put the word yet, and that keeps you going. So we have a number of different pieces of legislation we're looking at to keep bringing this issue back and getting more and more support and interest in it. Because obviously, you know, right now, people are rightly concerned about coronavirus. The irony for us, of course, is the evidence that's showing that sexual harassment and assault and domestic violence has gone up during lockdown. So even women in their homes, or women leaving their houses to go out, the little that they have, are facing more and more abuse and harassment. So it's never been more important to send the message that this isn't acceptable and do something about it.
And also very important to record the levels of misogynistic crime right now, because this is, as you say, a very important moment. I just also wanted to mention something else that was, I wasn't say in the domestic violence bill, but rather not in the domestic violence bill. And this was the fact that migrant women are penalised. MPs voted down the clause to lift the no recourse to public funds rule, which is part of the hostile environment. Do you think there's any chance of women like you in Parliament being able to get that changed?
I hope so. Obviously, move for the domestic violence bill itself moves to the House of Lords now. So it's had its third reading within the House of Commons, but hopefully there can be amendments made in the House of Lords that then come back to the House of Commons. And we'll continue to do that. I would encourage all of your listeners to go and look at the work that Women for Refugee Women are doing on this, because it's absolutely heartbreaking. And also the South All Black Sisters, because right now there are two classes of women in this country: the women who have the protections that the domestic abuse bill will bring, and the women from migrant communities who won't, because still too often their status is dependent on the person who sponsored their visa, and that gives that person a huge amount of control over them. And this is just a classic example of it and what needs to change. It's also something I feel very strongly about because it means that we're not compliant with the Istanbul Convention. And people might have seen that there's now a real push across Europe to roll back on the Istanbul Convention. So I think it's really important that the UK, which is one of the few countries that hasn't yet ratified that convention, speaks up to it. But one of the things it's very clear about is that it shouldn't matter your status, whether you're able to access support and protection from violence as a woman. We can't say that in the UK right now for migrant women because we make these distinctions about people's access on the basis of their status in the immigration system. That has to change, and I hope that Lords will do that. I know we'll be trying to petition and lobby our colleagues in the House of Lords to do that in the coming weeks.
Now, I just want to move on to talking about the COVID crisis, lockdown, and the disproportionate effect on women. Now, obviously, you know, there's a lot of the deaths have been male, and you know, that's a fact. But if you look at the how the sort of burden's been spread from, you know, just the pressures of homeschooling, we talked about domestic violence, a lot of women's jobs are more at risk. You know, it's been a very, very tough moment for the sort of gendered aspect of the economy. And do you think that, I mean, what's your kind of take on that? And let's start, I suppose, with childcare, because it does feel that that's an area that women are really taking a hit on, like every which way at the moment.
Well, actually, we should start with pregnancy because it starts there. So what we're starting to see is pregnant women being put onto statutory pay rather than being furloughed or being told that they have to come into work, otherwise they're going to lose their jobs, full stop. And of course, you're supposed to be protected when you're pregnant. Women facing redundancy even though they're pregnant, because employers are using the fact that we're in a pandemic to bypass the traditional employment rights, and women being given inconsistent guidance. In fact, I've got cases right now of women who are in their late trimester of pregnancy who've been housed in houses of multiple occupancy, even though the guidance says that you are somebody who should be shielding. Same as there are 2/3 of women who want to return to work in the next couple of months can't do because they can't get childcare. The TUC research shows us that. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to work out that, you know, if the schools aren't back full time, if nurseries are closed, then those people who end up sharing the burden of childcare responsibilities are going to find it harder to be able to go back to the normal working patterns that they previously had. It does take somebody being in the room to raise that and ask that question. And what I found in raising questions about childcare virtually in Parliament, because obviously I can't get childcare myself, is that it's a bit like most things with women, where it's kind of like talking Klingon, in that you say the word women and the ministers hear the word women and they don't hear anything else. So they'll come back to you with their answer about something to do with women, which is absolutely nothing to do with the question that you've asked. So, you know, I've asked about the provision of childcare. I've asked about the childcare sector. Again, you know, good luck trying to socially distance three-year-olds. So if you can't socially distance them, you can't have as many of them in a nursery, which means that you haven't got as many places generating the funding that keeps them open. Most nurseries in this country were not particularly making a lot of money. They were just about breaking even. As soon as you reduce the numbers in them, a lot of them are going to go bust. Obviously, a lot of people can't take their kids back to the nursery just yet either. The Chancellor hasn't got a Scooby about any of this. When I asked him about it, it was like talking Klingon, and he started talking about the self-employment scheme as though that was relevant to nurseries. There is so much more work that needs to be done to prevent a massive cliffhanger of women's unemployment and redundancy and destitution coming in about September, October. And I'm very concerned because I'm not sure I see that work being done at a national level as yet.
I just wanted to talk about it's carrying on the theme of a very masculine type of politics. You know, you and I talked after the conviction of Charlie Elphick, former Tory MP for sexual assault, and we have seen the arrest of another unnamed MP for alleged rape. Why is this problem not getting any better, Stella?
Because I think people presumed it would do because it was surfaced, and that was a misunderstanding of what was behind it. I mean, there is a systematic challenge, as I say, which comes from the default. And the default isn't just about an individual. It's about a culture and a way of life that means that if you are in a position of power, different rules apply. And all too often, being in a position of power is being a white man of a certain age of independent means. it also means that you get to set the terms of the debate. And one of the things I think we have to do is change the way we talk about these things. So we very often we talk about the people who come forward. We talk about what is missing rather than what we're asking people to go into. I am very clear that we have to change the culture of politics, of business, because this is not unique to politics, of our society, before we ask women and those from minority communities who are excluded to change to fit in. But all too often, we do it the other way around. It's what I like to call the Piers Morgan effect. So Piers Morgan will tell you that we've had, you know, a woman monarch, and we've had two women prime ministers, and we've had a woman run the fire service, and we've got a woman as a leader of the Metropolitan Police. You know, because there are women everywhere that he can see. And it's that sort of, well, if they can do it, others can do it, job done. And it misses the point. Until it is unexceptional that you have women in a diverse range of places, and we change the culture in which sexual abuse and harassment is a perk of the job rather than professionalism being the attitude that all must take, these things will continue on. What I particularly worry about, and where I think there's a really uncomfortable conversation for all of us, is that because this is about the culture, it is, let's call it what it is, the P word, patriarchy, women can be part of it too.
Yeah.
So there are women in all walks of life who have sat by, looked the other way, kept quiet, not supported a colleague to come forward when they've experienced these things. It is a very difficult thing to do to support someone. It's a very difficult thing to do to come forward. But this will only change when we do all work together to say this is no longer acceptable. And we flip the conversation. So we start talking about the perpetrators being held to account rather than women having to come forward, or what women haven't done to make it easier to come forward.
Absolutely. No, I completely. Well, I was actually having a conversation with somebody about the situation about the alleged rape. And it was an older gentleman who actually said, his first question was, has she got form on this? I mean, that was the first question.
One of the other things I feel very strong, so I have experienced maternity discrimination since I became a mum within my job. And actually, it's been interesting. It's been the older men who have called for provision to be made for me to be able to have childcare and be able to be part of conversations, be a part of leadership roles. It's the younger women and the older women who said, well, I managed, why can't you? And it's part of that same culture that says it is the way it is, that there must be a reason why somebody's coming forward to make a scene rather than somebody behaving inappropriately or somebody being part of discrimination. And that's why, look, we can have all the independent processes that we need. I mean, we still need to go a long way in having those independent processes for dealing with sexual abuse and harassment. But fundamentally, we also need to change the culture and environment that people are going into.
Well, look, I'm so, you know, Stella, it's been so great to have you on. You and I could just kind of, like, we could banter on for like another sort of 2 hours, but our time has come to an end. Thank you
and
so much.
And I have
to deal
with the pitchfork mob from Hackney coming down the road at me.
I just have one question before you go. Have you got your first indie gig in the diary for when? Hopefully when, not if, live music ever starts up again. Who is it and where?
This is genuinely true. So not only have I got the reorganized Suede gig, but brilliantly, I saw that Martin Rossiter is touring doing Gene's old back catalogue. Now that makes me incredibly aged and dated, but immediately I bought tickets for that. And I thought, hell or high water, babysitter or not, COVID or not, even if I have to be the only person in the room, I want to be there to hear him do Olympian.
And do you have an album that's been getting you through isolation?
Actually, because I've been watching a ridiculous amount of TV rather than listening
all the telly
to music. Yeah, so I've actually been more into TV than I have been. I mean, look, obviously, I had a listen to Taylor Swift. I know it is a cry. Look, I loved Lover. I thought Lover. I thought the song "The Man" again, a bit like the Hillary documentary, will really, really wind you up. And Georgia Smith as well, I've done a bit of listening to, quite like that. But I thought the new Taylor was a bit, it's a bit Mumford and Sons, isn't it?
Wow, Stella, that's harsh.
Yeah,
it's
but fair.
Harsh, but fair.
It's a cardigan, love. Get over it.
Well, Stella Greasy, thank you so much for joining us on the Bunker Daily. Listeners, thank you for listening. Remember, there's a new Bunker Daily every Monday, Tuesday, Thursday and Friday with the main panel podcast on Wednesdays. You can get each edition early and without adverts, plus our glittering range of Bunker merchandise too, when you back us on Patreon. Search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more. Thanks for listening. We'll see you again.
Bunker Daily was presented by Aisha Hazarika and produced by Andrew Harrison. The assistant producer was Jacob Archbold, and audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.